Hey, I'm Emily Chenevert, advocacy nerd, Peloton enthusiast, wife and mama to two, and CEO of the Austin Board of Realtors. Every day, real estate is changing, so we're taking it to the experts to unpack major topics that you need to know about to be successful in this business. Scratch what you think you know about this business and listen up for a fresh take on an old industry. Hey guys, I couldn't be prouder to introduce to you my guest, Alan Graham, especially as we're recently embarking on a new partnership that will help create homes for those experiencing homelessness in Austin. As many of you know, ABOR recently announced that we will commit $1 million to Community First. This is an amazing and innovative project that was spearheaded to give hundreds of people experiencing homelessness a place to live, a community to belong to, and an opportunity to rebuild their lives. As Austin and so many other large markets have grown, we've experienced an increase in the number of residents experiencing homelessness. Many of you know what this is like in your communities as well. This has led to a standoff in Austin between city and state. There are numerous suggestions on how to tackle the issue, but the person who has been in the trenches for more than two decades is my guest, Alan. He has been helping the chronically homeless in Austin, both through his organization, Mobile Loaves and Fishes, and through innovative and creative Community First Village. This was our first ever Scratch That podcast recorded in front of a live audience, and I was thrilled that Alan could give us his insight into how vulnerability can help transform our industry. After all, Alan would know. He was a real estate investor and developer before dedicating his life full-time to Mobile Loaves and Fishes. Join me as we learn what it really means to be a part of building and living in an innovative community dedicated to serving the chronically homeless. Alan, thanks for being my first live Scratch That podcast guest.
Yeah, great.
This is fun.
Here.
Usually I'm in a hotel room with people sort of awkwardly rushing through interviews, or I'm doing it remotely, but rarely do I get to do it at a time that I see our audience actually absorb what we're talking about. So I'm super excited about that. I have a belief that when I boil down what realtors really do, and I talk about it to people who are not in the business, who are, or when my parents ask me what it is that I do exactly, because it's confusing them still, I tell them that I think that realtors build community. That's really, at the end of the day, that's what I think that they do. And so, given that you have literally built a community in the Community First Village brought to us by Mobile Loaves and Fishes, how do you define what a community is?
I think that's a great, interesting question. I think it's a question that we're trying to rediscover in the United States. For me, I grew up, raised my family in the Westlake Hills area, which I just absolutely loved. Wouldn't trade that for anything in the world. I lived on Redbud Trail on an acre and a quarter overlooking the Wild Basin. It was a phenomenal place. We kind of knew our neighbors, but not really necessarily. We were obviously in our zone of raising our family, and I never forget one time driving into my driveway, which was about 100 yards long, going back on a flag lot, and I stopped to get the mail out of our mailbox, and the son in his mid-40s of my neighbors that were in front of us was out, and I said, "Hey, Tate, how you doing?" And he says, "Great, Alan, how you doing?" I said, "How's your mom and dad?" And he looked at me and said, "You didn't know." And I said, "No, what?" He goes, "Well, mom died 2 years ago." And it was a kind of a bone-rattling experience that to this day has me continuing to reflect on. And why is it that in that environment off of Redbud Trail on these acre-plus size lots, none of us took the initiative to actually get to know who we are? And I think when you think about community, it's all about getting to know who each other are. It's one of the things that's interesting about the village, because people will say in the village that, you know, get out of my business. Well, it's impossible in the village to not be in your business. We're just there and we're around each other all the time, so we're going to know all the things. But in our homes, it's difficult to do that. How do we get out? And I've got some ideas that if I was the home czar of the U.S. of what I would do, but we can talk about that later.
So. Yeah, we will. You know, I guess I think the thing that's interesting about that is when, certainly as I think about it as a mama, I think about what I want to give them when I search for the right community for our family, or when we have done that in the past. you think you're doing right. The area of Austin that you described is beautiful and affluent and a wonderful place to raise children by all the metrics that we all use, the schools and the soccer clubs and whatever else. But what you're describing is an experience that was somewhat empty with regards to one of our most innate needs, and that need is to connect with others. So how do we make right with hitting all the metrics that society tells us we should hit in preparing our kids for their future, but then still hit their innate needs?
I think, you know, when you look at how we build subdivisions today, if you go back to the 1950s, I was born in 55, the average size of a single family home, 958 square feet with 3.6 people living in that house. So that was 250 square feet per person. Today, or whenever I searched those numbers, I saw that the average single family home was 2,500 square feet with 2.5 people living in there. So we've gone from our own families, you know, having 250 square feet per person to 1,000. And that alone, just inside of our homes, is a separation, a disconnectedness. And then when I think about growing up, there were no privacy fences. You had the old 4-foot cyclone fences that any reasonable kid could hop over. And that's and that's what you did. You just moved from one yard to the next yard as you were doing whatever it was that you were doing as a kid. But now there are these wooden 6-foot, 8-foot tall privacy fences. If I was the home czar, I would like to see a subdivision built. Wouldn't this be interesting to build a subdivision where for every square foot of inside space, so let's say it's a 2,000 square foot house, you must have 1/3 of a square foot on a front deck. Okay? And then we essentially eliminate the backyard and move the house as close to the front of the street as you possibly can. So when you're out there on your front porch, you're ginormous, wonderful with, you know, big ass ceiling fans, cooling, and couches and chairs and hospitality areas, and people are walking the dog, you could look, hey, Emily, Kent, you know, Brian, whatever, you know, and the next thing you know, you're having a conversation with each other. I think there's some things that we could do that doesn't necessarily change our current lifestyle, but actually enhance that by doing some simple things.
You've just made the case for my husband's man cave in the garage, so I'll have to pay for that later, given that he's hung a TV and a beer fridge there. But the reality of that experience for our family is that we're the only ones outside out front. But we want that for our kids, and we want them to run and play and be in community as well. And I think many families want that. And I think realtors have kind of an interesting role in helping advocate for that value as a metric when homeowners are looking for the right home and the right community. So maybe that's a takeaway, you know, for this group, is that you do have an opportunity and a role in shaping communities in terms of how we define what we really want and what your consumer might really need and want as well.
If you think about production home builders as an example, they get their product pretty much is lined up like little soldiers, and they're just repeating it, and then every now and then there'll be a facade change. It's kind of a rinse and repeat. But maybe we could encourage a few to, I mean, like right now we're doing 3D printed homes, the second ever in the history of the world. 3D printed home was printed out the village, and now we're printing in the middle of printing 6 more. Let's look at innovation. You don't have to start by building a full subdivision of homes that have got 1/3 square foot per, you know, square foot thing, like I said earlier. But maybe if they would just build a couple and see how those sold. If that went well, you know, double down on that and ease into a thing like that.
So you've pointed out one of the things that is most unique about the village is how innovative you've been in sort of turning the way that others have addressed chronically homeless brothers and sisters on its head. You're doing it differently.
Right.
But tell me the ways that you think are most profound that you're doing it differently. Why does it matter the way that you've built the village?
Well, the way that we address poverty in the United States is very transactional. And humans happen to be very relational. And so I think it's great that we feed people and that we help house people. But what people need more than anything is to be fully and wholly loved and fully and wholly known. So how do we create communities that's all about the relationship and not about the transaction? And I think that's the key, is looking at what is it that's human, and how do we build more humanness into our communities, where people are not being forced, but invited into the built environment that's outside. If it's all concrete and full of automobiles, it's not an inviting place. And so what are the things that we can create inside of our communities? Like, what is the number one conduit that connects human to human, heart to heart? It's simply food. Everything that we do when we get together, our first date, is typically around food or drink or something like that. So why not, inside of our communities, create these unbelievable spaces where people can come together? I bet there's more potlucks per capita in the Community First Village than anywhere else in the world. Because we have all those awesome kitchens that are around. I mean, everything is just about bringing together people over food. So why not look at that?
Yeah, that screams to a Southerner's heart, so that's good too. But but that makes sense to me, is that what I think you're saying is that in lieu of serving the tactical need that's so obvious when someone is experiencing homelessness, you served an innate need. You served that immediate need to connect and to feel loved and to be needed and valued through providing opportunities to work and contribute to that community as well.
Yeah.
And that does seem to be the big difference when I look at what you're doing compared to what so many others are trying.
You know, people that move into our community being chronically homeless, they come with a variety of issues. Addictions happen to be one of those issues. We're doing a giant tour day before yesterday. There's about 50 people out there, and we're in the amphitheater where our outdoor Alamo Draft House movie theater is. And I see a guy walking down Goodness Way to Hawkeye Road. I know exactly what's going on. He's standing at the end of the entry drive, and he gets on his phone. Then a car comes down Hawkeye and then passes, and he starts walking down this sidewalk, and the car turns around. He meets the car. I don't see it because there's a detention pond there. And then he walks back out, and I leave the tour, and I walk up to my friend, and I said, "Brother, I know exactly what just went on. And I want you to know that I'm not judging you or condemning you, but I want you to know that I care for you. And when you're ready for help, you need to let me know." But I needed him to know that I saw that completely visibly, and he can't pull the wool. He tried to, you know, make some explanations, but there is none. I know this deal. But he now knows that I know. And wouldn't that be important in your own neighborhood to know, to be able to shine the light on things that are going on, you know? Like, if you knew your neighbors well and you knew that one spouse was beating up the other spouse, wouldn't it be good for that to be exposed? Or if somebody's deep into an addiction, alcohol or drug addiction, which is in every one of our neighborhoods, or deep into depression, you know, or a mental health issue, I know, and if you need help, let me know, because I see that you're in pain. But we're hidden from a lot of that.
So not everybody's wired to see people the way that you see them. Even just in our conversations 101, you dig deep pretty quick. And I like that, because I do the same sometimes. But what makes Alan Graham the person that can approach building community in this way? Why are you doing this? What led you initially to begin your service with Mobile Loaves and Fishes and in serving brothers and sisters?
Well, mine was a spiritual journey, and I ended up developing this very intellectual relationship with Jesus, frankly, on an extraordinarily reluctant basis. And I ended up going on this men's retreat in 1996 that, had I known that men were going to hold hands with each other, Kent, you know what I'm talking about, bro? Yeah, much less. And
now, remember, we're all about connecting.
Yeah. I'd have never gone, but I ended up in this deal, and it just turned out to be that deal. And I spent hours in the most uncomfortable environment that one could imagine. And then there was a transformation during that period of time that had me questioning where I was personally headed in my life. It had me looking at my family and how much I valued my family versus valued wanting to become the next Trammell Crow, which was, you know, one of my fantasies. You know, how do I want to serve my community? And it wasn't like there was this revelation at that point that I'm going to be out of the real estate business someday and doing something like Mobile Loaves and Fishes. But, you know, how can I be more attentive to who I am to my family and to my church community. And God is, in my humble opinion, is quite insidious because he throws these little things at you to go and do these little things. And then the next thing, the little things added up to a big thing. And I'm going, hey, dude, I really wanted to become a millionaire over here doing this thing over here. Still a real estate developer, but that's a bait and switch, man. How'd you do
that? Your version of real estate is a little different than the ones that I see on a daily basis. Yeah. Okay, so you had the profound calling. Affirm that there were opportunities in your life to serve better and to do different. You launch Mobile Loaves and Fishes. And then eventually, and especially in your book, you talk about that leading eventually to the need to create a full-on community to serve the people that you had been serving more transactionally before then.
Yeah.
What would you tell someone who doesn't understand the people that you serve? What do they need to know about someone who's experiencing homelessness?
First of all, you have to get down and meet people where they are. It would be extraordinarily helpful for us to get out of our automobiles and go over and talk to the people that are on the street corners. No matter what's portrayed anywhere, they're not violent. It's not a risk to be in the middle of the city to do that. And that doesn't mean that there's zero risk. There's plenty of risk for you just to get in your automobile and drive down 360 or Mopac or 183. You could get whacked today and that would be it. But we make that conscious choice to do that every day. Knowing that there's, frankly, a far higher risk that we're going to be in a bad auto accident than we're going to be mugged by a homeless person. I mean, like a million times more likely. And so you get to know them, and then you begin to understand who they are and what their journey's like. And it's just like my question of you and then learning about your little boy and the power of knowing, just knowing that. It transcends our relationship in a very profound way. I think also, who are the Brene Brown people in here?
Yeah. Lots of hands up.
All women. Let me tell you, I'm going to the Brene Brown. I got a ticket. But the vulnerability side of it is, I think, is for each and every one of us, because when we understand how flawed we each are, it allows us to be closer and less judgmental of who we are. And I think when we begin at home, when we begin with our friends and begin to share the things that are going on in our life, and then it empowers us to go out on the streets, because you want to talk about Brene Brown people. That's the people on the streets. They will vomit out all the things that probably should be kept in a skeleton closet somewhere. But when they do, it empowers you to be able to share those little nuggets with people. And then now we start becoming a tribe and a clan. That's the deal. Because we mask it all. We wear the clothes, we drive the car, we're all pretenders in some way or another. I consider every human on the planet to be a liar, a manipulator, and a deceiver. Because none of us are really telling the absolute truth, We wake up in the morning, we put on clothes, we put on makeup, we do the bathing thing, we try to look and see what looks, exactly right, but that's not exactly, who we are.
When I think about my realtor community especially, you're in this unique position to really carry out what Alan is asking you to do, which is to connect with people. You connect with people each and every day. But if you can find that opportunity to do it with someone that makes you a little bit uncomfortable, or who you perceive might not want to connect with you, I think that's a really powerful tall order. So you have a podcast too. What made you want to do that?
Well, it's called The Gospel Con Carne. It's the gospel with meat.
Seems appropriate in Austin, Texas.
It's a gritty Tex-Mex theology. And there's a great story behind the development of that that involved fajitas, of course. But it's also this recognition that for those of us that go to church and proclaim Christianity as our faith, but it doesn't matter what your faith life is, most of us are going to church and we're hearing the word, no matter where that word's coming from, whether it's from Jewish scripture, Christian scripture, the Bhagavad Gita, the Quran, or wherever that's coming from. And then we leave that environment and we go to Macaroni Grill for lunch. And then we go spend the rest of the afternoon on Lake Travis. And then next Sunday or Saturday or whatever the day is, it's rinse and repeat. Then it's rinse and repeat. But when these words are being proclaimed, wherever these words are, there is some prophetic elements to these words. There's a innate calling to each of us. And even if you're not of faith, there's an inherent sense of goodness, period. That's our deal, goodness, but period. And how do we fulfill that? What is the meat that we can put on that deal? How do we empower and inspire people to get out of the pew, metaphorically, and get into the world, into a place that actually makes us extremely uncomfortable? And it's amazing what happens when we enter into that place of discomfort to discover something so much bigger than who we are. And so the gospel incarnate is all about putting the meat on that word, because the words is one thing, which is great words, but how do you put the meat on that deal? One time a month is with one of our neighbors from the village, and we dive into where they've come from, and let me tell you, man, some stuff gets thrown out on that deal that's pretty amazing. And then one time a month is somebody that's influential and resourced, like a Kirk Watson or John Paul DeJoria or people like that. And let me tell you, man, I've had 100 millionaires and billionaires on that podcast breaking down and crying as they're diving back into their family life and sharing the things. You know, you talk about a DeJoria, man, his father was absent. His mother was a single mother. He lived in his car for a while. He was part of the Hells Angels biker group. You meet the guy. I don't know what he's worth, $4, 5, 6 billion dollars. He doesn't travel with security. It's amazing. And then you have other people that fly in, and there's like, you know, all the people with the things in their ears. No telling what kind of armor's up underneath the coat. And
Yeah.
Hey, y'all. I want to take a quick break to tell you about ThinkUp. ABOR is bringing a two-day professional development conference to Austin on April 7th and 8th. This is a high-energy experience and is not to be missed. We're bringing in major players in the real estate industry, such as Gary Keller, Hal Elrod, and our Scratch That alum, Joseph Rand. And we're announcing more speakers every week. I want you to come, work all day, stay all day, and we're going to bring immediate impact to your business. Go to www.thinkupaustin.com to learn more and register today. I really hope to see you there. Now let's get back to our episode.
You know, in so many ways, people talk about social media, especially as a means of being really disconnected from community. I shared with you my story that my young son's, I identified his live kidney transplant donor through social media. So I come at Facebook with a lot of love, despite all the hell it brings in my life sometimes. What do you think about social media, especially in the context of you talking about homes as carcassophaguses?
And recluding.
Yeah, you say it better than me. But
I was an early adopter of social media on a personal level. So I think I was a Facebook member since 2007. I'm a fan of leveraging that technology for good. I can tell you that the only thing I do now is my own personal Facebook page. I have nothing to do. And we have a communications department that does all that. I don't want to do Twitter or Snapchat or Instagram. They try to talk me into that stuff, and I go, look, I'm done, man. Y'all do that deal and pretend it's me.
Yeah. So when I tagged you on my Insta story earlier, it wasn't you? The truth comes out.
It's very powerful. If you look at my Facebook feed, it's apolitical. It's really all about mobile loaves and fishes. And every now and then I'll post a picture of a Dairy Queen dip cone. Yeah. And then, you know, it's the Dairy Queen dip cone that got more comments than anything, you know, on the planet.
I think that's powerful. I think it's interesting to see someone who believes so firmly in what we would traditionally think of as community, being one-to-one, here together to find opportunity to leverage something that's new and that is a little bit disconnected but can still create those meaningful relationships. So yeah. Good on you for doing that. You should still get on Instagram. You would really love it.
La, 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 la.
No, I just, you know. You got to dig into something new, Alan. Yeah. Come on. Well, this has been awesome. I appreciate you, your vulnerability, and so appreciate you speaking of this partnership that the Austin Board of Realtors is committed to with our listeners on the podcast and our members here today. Thank you all for being here for our first live podcast recording and for being a part of our new chapter at the Austin Board of Realtors. We're so appreciative of you.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in. Like what you hear? Let's continue this conversation. Give us some love by leaving us a review on iTunes and let your friends know about the show by sharing this episode on social media. You can also follow along and tag me at M. Shinover. That's E-M Shinover. Until next time.